4. Pink. Haley walks through the doors at the Cabela's on Desert Boulevard at 10 a.m. She packed the Warhawk in her checked bag, of course, but ran short of time to purchase ammunition for the custom 1911 handgun. Federal HST 45 caliber 230 grain? She asks one of the sales agents working the floor in the roomy gun department of the vast store. The salesman grins, appreciating a woman who knows her guns.
Coming right up. How many boxes are we talking?
6.
You got it.
The salesman gets hopping. Another customer followed Haley into the gun department and witnesses the speedy transaction. Stocky, dressed in jeans and work shirt that aren't ever going to come clean of the grime accumulated from long shifts on too many Permian Basin rigs to count.
Smart,
he says to Haley's back. She has no other option but to engage him. Sir? The scruffy chain hand gestures at the guns on display.
Putting some firepower in those pretty little hands. That's smart.
Haley nods, giving him a tight smile, one that he fails to read correctly.
I've got my own guns for sure. AR, my Rossi carbine, P320. But with the shit going down back home, I need to put some firepower in my old lady's hands. Something she can carry to the grocery store, know what I mean? Because they're coming all right. Right over the border, wall or no wall. Blowing up tank farms left and right. It's a fucking war zone. Excuse my French.
They?
Drug cartels, darling. Sinaloa, CDG, Los Zetas, Jalisco New Generation, you name it, cartel honchos are sending over their foot soldiers in retaliation for our cooperation with Mexican armed forces and La Chota. If this isn't a war, then I don't know what is. Why do you think the governor is sending in the Texas Army National Guard? And this is just the beginning. Better get more than 6 boxes, darling. I drove in all the way from Odessa. Can't buy a round of ammo for 100 miles back home. Shelves are empty. Shit's hitting the fan something serious in the basin.
She wears her Senate outfit. Sensible flats, white sleeveless blouse, and matching gray linen pants and jacket. The effect is business casual, not cop. Haley gave some thought to roping in Roy Pogue, the CID agent, for backup, but can't risk losing her one shot of interviewing Hooker without official interference. The deeper state operative has no idea what lies in store for her up in the dry moonscape above the Caballo Reservoir, and must be hyper-alert. There is always the risk that Hooker will recognize her from last night at the strip joint. Haley is confident he won't, the Army private being too distracted by the action on stage to have noticed her. She is too pragmatic, however, to ignore the possibility that she is wrong. That's when the Warhawk comes into play. The county road leads into higher elevations above the damned Rio Grande, into sparsely populated and arid hill country. The few houses Haley passes appear abandoned, falling down structures that have been ravaged by wind and rainstorm, wood siding sun-blistered, and roofs caved in. Near what seems to be the paved road's terminus, a turnoff leads to a single dirt lane posted by a mailbox and shotgunned no trespassing sign. She eases her rental car to a stop after turning onto the drive. No house or mobile home in sight, and shifts it into park. Haley performs a final check of her weapon and places the Warhawk on the front seat next to her. Exiting the car, she goes to the front left tire and crouches down to let most of the air out. From the trunk, she retrieves the jack and tosses it into the creosote bushes on the side of the road. Underway again with a flat tire, Haley follows the driveway up and over a ridge. Below is an occupied homestead, the first for miles. Hooker's truck is parked in front of a mobile home in addition to a Nissan pickup and a Suzuki four-door sedan. Salvage yard body parts are a common theme. So are missing wheel coverings, cracked windows, and windshields. The mobile home, perched on a foundation of cinder blocks, is the compound's primary structure. A 32-by-60-foot sheet metal barn to its north is larger, but the roll-down door is missing a few panels and remains open to the elements. The barn's interior is dark, but gaps in the siding reveal what appears to be a hoarder's wet dream. Haley stops about 25 yards from the mobile home, with the barn to her right. Keeping the car's engine running, she opens her door and climbs out. From her vantage point, standing next to her car, she can see a dilapidated 8x20-foot mobile construction shed positioned to the south of the trailer home. The trailer's tires have disintegrated, held together only by synthetic inner liners. Metal bars protect the shed's slider windows, and the steel door is padlocked. An odor of human waste wafts in Haley's direction from the bright orange 5-gallon Homer plastic bucket positioned under one corner of the construction trailer. Only a handful of seconds have elapsed since she exited the car when the mobile home screen door is pushed open. Tim Hooker emerges from its shadowy confines.
"Can I help you?"
he asks in a way that suggests he's not particularly interested in helping at all. The army deserter has swapped metallic dress and strappy heels for dusty blue jeans, cowboy shirt, and dirty white t-shirt. His snapback cap advertises a bar in Wink called the Doghouse. No saying if Timothy Hooker knows the name refers to the room on a drill floor, an oil rig's command central. Haley points semi-helplessly at the front flat tire on her car. "Got a flat. Some damn fool before me must have stole the jack." Hooker says nothing, just nods bobblehead-like. The deeper state operative squints one eye and cocks her head in a way she's seen in the movies. "Think I can borrow yours?"
"What are you doing way up here? That is, if you don't mind me asking."
Haley sees the curtain in one of the trailer windows move slightly. Suzuki, perhaps, or Nissan truck. Maybe both are in there. Haley feels the cold weight of the Warhawk riding in the inside-the-waistband holster she purchased once she'd shaken loose the overly friendly Odessa chain hand. An IWB carry seemed the best approach given the situation. Relatively quick draw, thin profile, and highly concealable. More important, she can still access her weapon if there's a struggle and she ends up on her back. "Looking at some property to buy, back down the road a mile."
"Conway Place? White and blue trailer?" asks Hooker.
She draws a blank. Haley knows there's no white and blue trailer on the unmarked county road because she paid attention when heading up. She says, "Fitzgerald's. Rusted out stock tank on the knoll up above the Stovin Ranch House." The mailbox had been missing a couple of press-on letters, but she was able to wheel a fortune, I guess. 10 acres. Good piece of land." A second man joins Hooker in the doorway of the trailer. No shirt, wrap beard, and scraggly chest hair. His jeans are more grease-smeared than blue. Bandages wrap his left hand.
He says, "Help the lady out, Tim."
Nissan truck, Haley designates him. Where's Suzuki? Hooker mutters something in the other man's ear, eyes on Haley, then leaves the mobile home's open doorway. He comes down the two homemade steps, walking toward the rental car. Did he recognize me from last night? The army deserter stops at the front of the rental car and, hands on his hips, stares at the tire. Nissan truck steps through the open doorway and stops on the small landing, made from scrap plywood and cinder blocks.
"Looking at it ain't gonna fix it, dummy."
Hooker shoots a pissed-off look back in the other man's direction, then stomps to the back of the car and pops the trunk. Haley is confident he won't likely discover boxes of ammo she hid under the passenger seat. The army deserter excavates the donut spare from its secured placement under the trunk mat and throws it in the dirt near the car's front. Haley watches him stride off toward the metal barn where he intends to fish a jack from somewhere within its bowels.
"Come inside. Get out of the sun."
Nissan truck's smile reveals lackadaisical dentistry.
"I'm good," Haley says with reasonable casualness. "Come on now, no sense standing out there sweating in the hot sun."
Haley prefers her chances outside, but confirming Suzuki's whereabouts is the more significant priority. If there are more than three of them, the odds begin to shift against her. The deeper state operative walks to the steps leading up into the trailer home. The shirtless desert rat moves aside with surprising courtliness to facilitate her entry. Haley climbs the two steps and enters the mobile hovel. The large Nazi flag hanging on one wall would be difficult to miss were it not for an even more distracting bearded fat man, naked, except for black thong bikini underwear, seated below it in a recliner chair. The combination of the two, Nazi flag and nude fat man, is a shock that Haley manages to mask with nothing more than a raised eyebrow. They just keep getting nakeder and nakeder. Suzuki, she decides. With luck, there are no other people elsewhere inside the trailer. The fat man doesn't look like he'd be much in a fight. Unless he has a gun hidden somewhere between his voluminous body mass and the recliner's seat cushion.
We don't get many visitors up here at Rancho Coco Puffs.
Suzuki's phlegmatic voice comes from somewhere deep within all of that flesh. Haley is now certain there is a gun beneath his right thigh, observing a hint of blue steel peeking out from beneath the fat man's hairy leg. Drawing it will take some doing, she calculates, and puts most of her concern in the more agile Nissan truck, who has shifted his position to outflank her. The doorway is effectively blocked. Suzuki watches her closely. She orients her gaze on the Nazi banner. Staring at the nude, bearded fat man would be the alternative.
You ain't Jewish, are you?
Asks the seated man. Haley meets his taunting gaze. Is it that obvious? The right-handed Nissan truck grabs an aluminum baseball bat propped against the wall and raises it over his head, lunging toward Haley. She draws and raises the Warhawk, nearly poking the charging man in his right eye with the barrel end. But as Nissan truck shrinks from the gun pointed at his head, Haley hears the low squeal of ancient recliner chair groaning under the obese weight of Suzuki. Knows, too, that the fat man is going for another gun and not the one under his elephantine thigh. The backup gun. Turning and acquiring her target before she fires, Haley takes the trigger to the wall and then some. The 230 grain jacketed hollow point round does the sort of damage to a human head its engineers envisioned, which is to say, total damage. And she hopes, frankly, that she hadn't made a mistake in thinking she saw him bringing up the hand cannon. Because, though she has killed, she has never killed casually, never without cause. No time to verify any of that now, because Nissan truck, with the gun off him, comes back at her, swinging his bat. Wishing it were his right hand that was bandaged and out of commission, Haley ducks below the arcing bat. Strike one. Stop! She has a gun, after all, a Nissan truck only a baseball bat. Haley had displayed her willingness to use it. The headless Suzuki, his bloody beard splattered across the Nazi flag, is proof positive of that. Nevertheless, Nissan truck presses forward with his attack. Driven by what? Revenge? He brings his bat down, missing Haley and demolishing a rickety TV tray table instead. Strike two. Damn it, drop the fucking bat! Haley has had her shot all this time, but has held fire. The skinny shirtless man raises the bat again, breathing heavily from his exertions, and howls like a Viking berserker. Haley shoots the man, center mass, throwing him backward against the opposite wall, the exit wound in his back leaving a bloody skid mark all the way down. Called strike three. You're out. There's no sign of Hooker outside, having taken the precaution of hiding both of Suzuki's firearms. He had indeed retrieved a sawed-off shotgun from the floor when Haley blew his head off. Haley walks down the steps and across the gravel drive to her rental car. She checks the back seat and under the vehicle. Nothing. If Hooker is hightailing it on foot, she would see him on the road leading up the opposite ridge. Her eyes fall on the cavernous metal barn with the fucked-up roll-down door off its tracks. He's in there. And it's up to me to get him out. The Warhawk held down at her side, Haley strides toward the barn. Her desire is to take the army deserter alive, and not get killed. In that order. As she approaches the barn's non-functioning door, her worst fears about what's inside are confirmed. The barn-like structure's entire interior is crammed with a hodgepodge of junk stacked in piles that reach halfway to the ceiling. Haley stops in the open doorway, raising the Warhawk and gripping it with both hands. Tim Hooker! Only the sound of wind rattling the metal barn's loose joints is the response. Come on out, Private. Taking you back to the post. I'm not here to hurt you. The mobile home's screen door behind her bangs open and shut in the gusty desert breeze. That and the squawking of the barn's wind-buffeted sheet metal panels are the only sounds Haley hears in response. She's got to go in there. The deeper state operative enters the barn. If there's a light switch somewhere, she's not going to find it easily or quickly. Haley wishes she had a weapon light for the Warhawk's recon rail and silently reprimands herself for not buying one in town, or at least a goddamn flashlight. Narrow passages lead deeper into a darkness that grows more intense with every step away from the open doorway. Plastic water barrels, dusty computer components, stacks and stacks of half-collapsed cardboard boxes, crates of empty beer bottles, piles of cast-off clothing, piles of construction supplies, tools, random car parts, household and office furniture, more cardboard boxes, a small mountain of mannequins. And then it becomes too dark to see what forms the walls of her passageway. Haley can only sense and smell the presence of more and more chaotic debris. She keeps her gun ready, listening for the slightest sound that might betray Hooker's location. Haley stops, sensing danger. The hairs on her forearms stand up in prophetic alarm. Slowly inhale, and then exhale. The barn's metal walls and roof continue to rattle and groan. Hooker's faint footfalls betray his location to her immediate right, his form almost visible, something raised over his head barely distinct. Haley pivots, at the same time aiming for what she estimates will be his shoulder, and fires. The flash briefly illuminates Hooker advancing on her with a machete poised to strike. He goes down. The deeper state operative holsters her sidearm and drags a wailing Hooker to just inside the doorway, needing light if there's any hope of saving him. Any is the operative word. Haley now sees the .45 caliber hollow point slug has demolished the army deserter's shoulder, all but separating his arm at the glenoid socket. The glistening head of his right humerus juts from the mess of tissue that dangles from what's left of clavicle and deltoid muscle. Both of his parents were drug addicts who died from accidental overdoses within 2 months of each other. Raised by Bible-thumping grandparents in Sacramento, California, 14-year-old Tim Hooker clashed with their strident disciplinary beliefs. The rebellious teenager soon took to the streets. Cycling in and out of juvenile hall, young Hooker fell in with a skinhead gang that offered him family and unqualified acceptance. Espousing the most rudimentary racist beliefs, the all-white gang engaged in bloody ongoing turf wars with the Pope Street Crips and Barrio Pachuco Norteños. The day after his 19th birthday, he participated in the ritualistic murder of a former member who tried to leave the gang. Police apprehended most of the offenders, but Hooker, the trigger man, managed to escape by hiding from police in a dumpster. Without money, his street family in jail, and grandparents long since washed their hands of him. Tim Hooker enlisted in the U.S. Army and was on a bus heading to basic training the following morning. Haley estimates that Hooker has less than 2 minutes to live. She retrieves a cotton shirt from a pile of old clothing and folds it into the semblance of a dressing, compressing it against his subclavian artery. The army deserter screams. "You're going to be okay." His eyes find hers, panicking. "Calm down, man." Hooker grits against the pain, subsiding as he goes into hypovolemic shock. Blood pressure plummets. Adrenal glands go into hyperdrive. He's dying. Fast. Haley brings her face to only inches from his. She says, "You knew my father." No response. "Charlie Hicks." Nothing. Then, as a question, "Tommy Chill?" Still nothing. Haley knows she is losing him, losing her chance. She says emphatically, "Charles Hicks works at the Pentagon. You met him 3 times at the Aphrodite in the last year." His eyelids flutter as life ebbs. Too much blood lost. Hooker's jaw barely moves. "White nation." Haley clocks what he has said, the searing hate that motivates these words, and eases off her pressure on his injury. The faintest of smiles appears on Hooker's face. Eyes are almost closed now.
Storm rising.
Sitting back on her heels, she looks up from the dead man. Her eyes fall on the construction shed to the left of the mobile home. She needs to know what's inside. The smell drifting from that direction is strong evidence of human habitation. Or imprisonment? Haley stands and re-enters the barn, re-emerging seconds later with a crowbar. The construction shed is accessed by 3 metal grate steps, its doors secured with a heavy-duty hasp and shrouded padlock. Haley bangs on the door, twice, hard. Anybody in there? No answer. I'm coming in. A beat. I've got a gun. Yeah, if anybody's in there, they've probably gotten that idea, she thinks with a wry half-grin. Haley jams the end of the crowbar in the thin gap between the door and frame. Her leverage isn't enough to pull the door out, but the padlock hasp loses some of its purchase. She focuses her energies there, prying the hasp from the steel door. With a few minutes of effort, it swings open. The deeper state operative backs away, returning to the top step and draws her weapon, pointing it into the construction shed. She sees the detritus of human confinement, including scattered clothing, eating implements, empty and half-full gallon water jugs. Graffiti and messages scrawled on the interior walls. A man lying on his back wearing only pants and motionless near the doorway. Another man, Hispanic, no more than 20 years old, crouched in the farthest corner of the shed, staring back at Haley. Wide-eyed, terrified. The smell that wafts from the shed's interior is far worse than the stink outside. Death and decomposition. Haley holds her position, keeping the gun trained on the crouching man while she processes exactly what she is seeing. I'm not going to hurt you. The young man's expression doesn't seem to register her words. He can't speak English. She gestures for him to come out. The man tentatively stands up from his crouch. Haley walks backward down the steps, lowering her weapon but keeping it at her side. She points. Over there, please. Stand there. Blinking as he steps into the sunlight, the man seems to understand. He shuffles on unsteady legs to a piece of shade cast by the adjacent mobile home. Haley climbs the steps again, peers inside the gloomy shed, then looks down to the man lying on his back. He's dead. A couple of days, at least, she guesses. Haley backs out and goes down the steps again. The prisoner stares at the .45-caliber pistol in her hand. His fear is palpable. She holds out her hands in response, so he can see the gun, and then holsters it again. I'm not going to hurt you. I want to help. I'm here to help. She leans heavily into the last word, drawing it out so that the young man understands. Are they gone? The men, are they all gone? He asks in his rapid-fire Spanish. Haley may speak fluent Russian, but her Spanish comprehension is non-existent beyond the obvious phrases and words. The men imprisoned so many of us. Are they dead? Where are the others? I'm afraid they're dead. The North Americans captured us coming over the border. They imprisoned us here. These men are very bad. Are they dead? Did you kill them all? Where are the other immigrants? They must be dead, all dead. The deeper state operative picks out enough words to understand he is talking about Hooker and the other men she killed. Her gift for extraordinary memorization isn't limited to visual triggers. With echoic memory, associated with auditory stimuli, she retains every word the prisoner says, each inflection. Haley locks it down. Getting underway on the gravel road is simple business after finding an operational tire inflator in the barn. She keeps all the car windows open, driving back over the ridge and down the gravel road toward the interstate, 3 miles west, an absolute necessity with the odor coming off the disheveled young man sitting next to her. His name is Diego. That much Haley was able to figure out on her own. She suspects he is in a state of shock and probably suffering from the effects of severe dehydration. The man requires immediate medical attention. Haley checks her phone for a signal, Once she contacts CID agent Roy Pogue, the deeper state operative intends to return immediately to Timothy Hooker's hideout on the other side of the hill. Searching the compound for more clues before the authorities arrive is absolutely essential. Diego, once started, can't stop talking. To Haley's ear, seemingly without punctuation. In his excited Spanish, he says, "Three men, all bad. They would feed us only rice and beans once a day, and at times not even that much. In the beginning, there were 10 of us. We came from everywhere south, from Mexico, like me, but also from El Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras. I was the last one taken captive. I cannot remember how many days ago it was. I crossed over in May. What month is it now? Are you with the police? Border patrol? The men would come just after sundown and they would select 2 of us, taken away and driven somewhere. We would never see them again. One morning only a few days ago, one of our captors, tall and skinny white man, his hand was badly injured. I could see through a crack in the wall. He was in a lot of pain. His hand, his arm, very badly burned. A little doctor came later that day to help him, wearing the uniform of your army, camouflaged. 2 black bars here." He points to the center of his chest. "The little doctor who helped the injured man came into our cell and he tried to help us. I do not speak English, but I know the bad men told the little doctor not to bother with us. We were going to die anyway." Haley checks her phone again. Seeing that she has a signal, she gestures to Diego to stop talking. She has committed everything he has said to memory without comprehension. "Wait, okay? Just let me make this call." Feeling ridiculous, she knows he has no idea what she's saying. Haley pulls over to the side of the 2-lane road. The interstate is visible in the distance. Without one leaf of vegetation for miles, steep ravines and fissures fracture the descending hillside. The road seems precarious and temporary. A gusting wind, of course. The deeper state operative pops her door open and turns to Diego. "I'll be right back." 2 minutes. She holds up 2 fingers. 2 minutes. Sitting in his cubicle, the CID agent answers on the 3rd ring.
"Pogue?"
"Mr. Pogue, this is Haley Chill."
"Are you in a wind tunnel, Ms. Chill?"
Haley stands at the front of the car, staring out over the lunar landscape. "In a way. New Mexico, sir. I located Hooker."
"No kidding. I'll send some officers right over."
"Chief, I think you better come out too." Pogue senses what he couldn't possibly imagine. Cop instincts kicking in.
"What the hell happened?"
"He's dead, sir." Haley frowns as the line goes quiet. How long is this going to take? How much time do I lose having to deal with local authorities? Finally, Pogue says,
"Give me your exact location, Ms. Chill."
His tone of voice is flat. "He's pissed. Exit 59 off Interstate 25. You want the access road that takes you to the east side of the reservoir. At the terminus of an unmarked county road you'll find at Palito Canyon."
"Got it. Sit tight. We'll be there in 90 minutes.
Pogue disconnects. Anticipating the paperwork, interviews, and red tape that the shootout will generate, Haley suffers a brief agony. "I don't have time for this shit." The deeper state operative turns to get back in the car and sees that Diego is gone. She checks the vehicle's interior, looks up the road, and then scans the open country on either side. In a few seconds, she clocks him. The undocumented immigrant runs at the bottom of a deep wash heading south. He has about a 200-yard head start on her. Haley starts to give chase, but then stops only a few feet from the road's edge. She looks down at her shoes and then up at the rugged terrain. "There's no way." She says, "Shit!" Haley watches the young man scurrying off, quickly lost in the vast landscape, and turns back toward the car. "Tell me something I don't already know." Haley listens patiently as Chief Warrant Officer Roy Pogue, wearing one of a dozen tailored dark suits he owns, explains what he and other investigative authorities have uncovered in their preliminary search of the mobile home, barn, and construction shed. The compound swarms with uniformed New Mexico State Police and agents from U.S. Army Criminal Investigation Command. Though it's after 6 p.m., The sun is still high enough that mismatched chairs have been retrieved from the barn and set up outside in any available shade. Haley has been sitting in one of these wooden, straight-back chairs for the past 2 hours, watching Pogue and his colleagues work the site. Before they arrived, she thoroughly searched the mobile home herself, taking care to wear gloves while accessing boxes of papers and more than one computer device. The CID agent takes a seat, enjoying the respite of shade. He says,
"Some kind of satanic death cult is the best I can ascertain right now. The Nazi memorabilia is fairly obvious evidence for affinity with white supremacist beliefs."
Haley is way ahead of him, but plays dumb. The other two men?
"The big boy whose head you splattered all over his pretty flag was Charles Henry Wilcox, medical discharged more than 5 years ago. Never served overseas. His skinny friend was Anthony Joseph Furman. Did a couple of tours in the sandbox. BCD with 3 years in Leavenworth," says Pogue, referring to a bad conduct discharge.
"Four?
Aggravated assault on an officer."
She just looks at him, waiting for it.
"Yes, Miss Chill. A black officer."
Haley notes Pogue's admission of this fact with a brief silence. Changes tact. "What about the undocumented immigrant? His dead friend in the construction shed. There's evidence of several others having been confined in that box."
"Criminal Investigation Command wouldn't wish to speculate."
His grin is mirthless, dire even.
"But if you were to ask Roy Pogue, he might say this is some kind of sex cult thing."
The deeper state operative nods, almost imperceptibly. "Okay. Wouldn't be my first guess."
Pogue adds, "A lot of places up in these hills to bury the bodies."
Haley takes a breath and looks around. The New Mexico State Police are being particularly methodical in their investigation and evidence collecting. Making no effort to disguise her impatience, she asks, "Who's running the show here, Chief?"
"You have some place to be?"
"As a matter of fact, I do." Her decision not to elaborate appears deliberate, pointed even. County coroner personnel choose this moment to haul one of the sheet-covered bodies from the trailer. Their van is parked next to the beat-to-shit Nissan pickup truck. Pogue looks over his shoulder and eyes the procedure, then returns his attention to Haley.
He says, "Pretty fancy shooting for a Senate aide, I'd say."
"I know my way around a firearm, Mr. Pogue. Earning a blue cord will do that," she says, referring to the fourgere in light blue awarded to infantry-qualified soldiers in the U.S. Army. Haley Chill was among the first women to complete all infantry training brigade requirements successfully.
"And you say you bought the .45 today?"
"No, Chief, just the ammo. I'm licensed to conceal carry in Virginia and the District of Columbia. The paperwork is in the car. Shall I get it for you?"
Andrew Wilde made it possible for her to obtain the necessary licenses in a few hours.
Just one of the many perks associated with being an active member of the deeper state.
The CID agent waves off the offer. "I think you'll be able to leave directly, Ms. Chill. But maybe you can share a little bit more about the nature of the committee's investigation. Tracking Hooker to his hideout was risky, to say the least. I'm curious what compelled you to do such a thing, without backup."
She isn't prepared to reveal any specifics of her mission to Pogue, not until she knows more. The truth is, Haley doesn't know the subject of her investigation. Only a sense of the thing has emerged since her confrontation with Hooker and his cohorts. The broadest of outlines. One hint was a self-published copy of the Declaration of Independence by the Republic of Texas, signed in 1836, that she found on top of a stack of pornographic magazines in the bedroom. The Nazi artifacts, the men's toxic racism. What did Tommy Chill have to do with someone like Hooker? She's certain the two men met on three occasions at the strip joint. If Haley is to have any understanding of her father's fate, of the document she found hidden under the floor in his kitchen, she must plunge deeper into the abyss. The senator and his committee are investigating white supremacy in the military, Mr. Pogue. I can't go into any more detail than that. This sounds plausible enough to Haley's ear as she says it. The CID agent is somber as he processes the deeper state operative's vague response.
"Okay. Well, anything I can do to help,"
he says, matching her level of candor. Haley offers a tight smile, but something behind Pogue's back has caught her attention. "Who's that, do you think?" she asks. He had braked at first sight of the mess of vehicles and authorities assembled at the compound. Putting the truck in reverse, Peter Oswald backed up 15 yards over the other side of the ridgeline. Wearing loose-fitting black khaki trousers and a black button-down cotton shirt, he exits the truck and walks back to the rise. Even the cotton twill safari fedora he wears on his head is black. With bland facial features and expressionless eyes, Oswald seems from neither this region nor any other, for that matter. By design, he is nebulous. His clothes are a costume, purchased at a JCPenney in Midland. He bought the 12-year-old Ford F-150 pickup truck for $2,000 in Kermit. This morning's breakfast came from Dewey's in Odessa, a nearly 6-hour drive east. The Swarovski EL-15x56 HD binoculars strapped snugly in the harness he wears across his chest matter most. Texas being a state of vast reaches, Oswald has found practical use for the high-end field glasses. Through them, he has observed every incident of sabotage that has taken place in the state over the past 2 weeks. Oswald is especially glad to have the binoculars upon discovering the New Mexico compound overrun with local and military police. Within moments of his leaving the air-conditioned truck cab, sweat pricks the skin above his eyebrows. His lower back is killing him after several hours behind the wheel. Not unusual for a man near his 60th birthday. He remembers when his body was strong and his stamina seemed boundless. This physical degradation has weighed heavily on his emotional well-being in the past years. The breakup of his marriage and estrangement from his 3 grown children have taken a toll, too. Middle age is one long suck. This is why Oswald has seized this current operation with the zeal of a man with nothing to lose, breathing fire into a life that has become increasingly without meaning. The storm has given him reason to hope. But even that sense of renewed optimism can't restore the deteriorating L1 and L2 spinal segments of his lumbar vertebrae. Once atop the ridge, Oswald has an excellent vantage point over the compound in the wash below. Ignoring the numbness in his left foot, a symptom of his sciatica that rarely eases, he removes the binoculars from their harness and puts glass on the investigators, committing their faces to memory. Differentiating the military personnel from the local authorities is a trivial task. Oswald spent enough time in the U.S. Army to recognize a CID agent when he sees one. Is it the squared shoulders? Trimly cropped haircuts? Makes no difference anyway. That the compound was compromised is bad business. Judging by the bodies being carted away by the county medical examiner and lack of arrested suspects, all of his people down below are now dead. Just as well. Their roles in the operation are all but over and done. Low-level players in the plot. Whoever killed them did the cause a considerable favor. Their deaths save Oswald the trouble of killing them himself. Haley points to the hill that rises above the compound and the road out. She can just barely make out a man standing on the rise about a mile off. The occasional sun flare off what must be binoculars is the beacon. CID agent Roy Pogue squints, trying to bring the individual into focus.
The hell if I know.
Who's got a pair of binoculars? Haley asks the investigators within earshot. She stands and follows a state police officer to his cruiser. The officer retrieves a pair of binoculars and hands them to Haley. But putting glass on the ridgeline, she sees that the individual observing them has fled and reacts with exasperation. Fuck! Pete Oswald is back on the interstate in 15 minutes, heading south, back to Texas. As he drives, he calculates how much significant information the authorities might find at the site. Hooker and the others had a limited function in the overall operation. Their awareness of the organization beyond their individual cell was limited, as was their specific mission. Consequently, any exposure is contained. The paraphernalia discovered in the mobile home is not atypical for the region and the dead men's socioeconomic background. Oswald made sure Hooker and the others kept incriminating evidence to a minimum in the compound. The men had drawn a hard line in the sand when it came to the Nazi flag. A wild card is whether or not any of the undocumented immigrants were still on site at the time of the police raid. Hooker assured Oswald only yesterday that all of the captives were deceased. He certainly hopes so. The security breach is a textbook lesson in the value of compartmentalization. Oswald will make sure everyone at the ranch is aware of the situation. Any investigation by local authorities and the CID will require monitoring. The young blonde woman's presence was a surprise.
Who the hell is she?
Oswald decides the rental car must be hers. With only a few phone calls, he will have the woman's name and driver's license number, as well as her home address. And with not much more effort than that, Pete Oswald will know everything else there is to possibly know about the woman who seemed to exhibit authority over male investigators twice her age. Holding the pregnancy test in her urine stream, she realizes she hasn't called Sam since arriving in Texas. When was the last time they talked, anyway? Events of the previous 36 hours make her last night in Washington seem like another lifetime ago. The relationship with Sam was complicated almost before it could even be called one. As an operative for the deeper state, Haley's duties preclude a normal life. The fireman had been a unique and happy discovery. A romantic partner who gave her all the leeway she needed. Haley is strongly attracted to him. Theirs is a connection of significant fondness and affinity. Perhaps, under other circumstances, Haley could fall in love with Sam McGovern. Her involvement with Publius prevents that level of commitment. Dedication to the nation's constitution is her destiny. With enlistment in the army and embarking on her amateur boxing career, Haley stopped ovulating. Gradually at first, and then completely. Hormonal messages sent to her pituitary gland and ovaries were interrupted by a combination of non-stop military training and a strenuous exercise regime. The long-term failure to ovulate gave her a false sense of security. Practicing safe sex was a given. But with Sam, after a short time, the deeper state operative tended to be less vigilant. It has been almost 2 years since she had her period. Haley realizes now that all-consuming duties at the White House during the previous spring had enabled her hypothalamus to do its thing, getting her cycle going again. The earliest suspicion she might be pregnant arose only in the past week or so. Haley never felt so tired as during her last bout. Workouts seemed much more difficult, too. As a high-level athlete, she has always been keenly attuned to the subtle changes in her body. An increased pulse rate, hyperventilation, clothes just a little snug. Sporadic sluggishness. All were signs of something amiss. The thought occurred to her that she might have started ovulating again, in not-so-perfect timing with her intimate relationship with Sam. Hence the pregnancy test from Walgreens. Sitting on the toilet in the bathroom of her motel room, Haley places the test stick on a dry, flat surface as instructed. In this case, the bathroom sink basin. If one line appears in the result window, she is not pregnant. If two pink lines appear, then, well, she's screwed. In less than 45 seconds, Haley will have the results. She doesn't check her phone while she waits. She doesn't gaze out the open bathroom door and let her mind drift. Haley stares at the test stick, or to be exact, at the result window, and commands it to obey. One line, not pregnant. One line. Save the country. One, two pink lines appear in the test window.